America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Today we're going to be talking with David Sirota in the third hour of our program. Just an update on what's going on in the world. He's the author of Hostile Takeover. And semi-regular on the program, Peter Navarro is going to be with us about the coming China wars and our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. And right now, Keith Lockich is with us. Keith, am I pronouncing that right?
Lockich.
Lockich, thank you. With the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And I think it's always useful for us to listen particularly carefully to you guys over at Ayn Rand, because the objectivist thinking, the objectivist philosophy that Ayn Rand largely developed and wrote about probably first in her book, Atlas Shrugged, has become so much of the foundational thinking for the libertarians and for the Grover Norquist variety of conservatives, although I realize you guys disavow them. And this piece that this Ayn Rand press release, No Child Led Ahead, just, you know, lays this right out. You've got a problem with No Child Left Behind, and it's not that the program's not doing good enough. It's that we have public education at all. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So
I think No Child Left Behind is just one more attempt to reform, you know, a system of public education that's been dismal for decades. It's been reform after reform has completely failed, and I think what we need to look at, we need to look more deeply at why that's happened. I think the problem is inherent in having a very system of public education itself. What we should be moving toward is a system of totally free market private education.
So do away with public schools altogether.
Right. I mean, look, in any other industry, we recognize that, you know, letting the government run things is a catastrophe. You know, one of the main reasons communism fell is that the state was in charge of the economy. So why are we entrusting the minds of our children?
Keith, I would agree with you that letting the government run the manufacture of shoes and steel and things like that is a catastrophe. But are you saying that the United States Army, from the inception of this country, has been a catastrophe, that our police departments are catastrophes, that our fire departments are catastrophes?
No, there are certain functions that the government has to perform.
And they perform it quite well, thank you very much.
Well, they perform that those functions quite well because those are proper functions of government. The government is the institution in society that plays the role of the peacekeeper, the police, the military. Those are the functions the government has in society. It's basically protecting people from, you know, other people violating their rights.
Well, this is
what the government should. What the government shouldn't be doing is trying to run any kind of productive industry, producing goods or services, you know, that for people to consume.
But what does education have to do with productive industry? We're talking about giving people the basic stuff that you need to be functional in society. I've worked and lived in countries, not lived very long, but I've worked in countries where there are not good public education systems, where large percentages in parts of countries where large percentages of the kids in rural India, for example, you know, 90-95% of the kids are completely illiterate. I mean, totally, right on through.
And it's not
a good thing. I mean, you know, yes, they have privatized school systems. The rich educate their kids, the poor don't, but it doesn't work well for society.
Well, that's not true. I mean, there are poor
I've been there,
areas
I've seen it.
There are poor areas in Nigeria where over 70% of parents choose to send their kids to private schools rather than the free ones. They pay $2 a month, and they do it because they're better. I mean, one woman says, if you go to a market and you're offered free fruit and vegetables, they'll be rotten. If you want fresh fruit and vegetables, you have to pay for them. And that's the basic issue. If you want quality services, and education is a service, you know, you need to pay for it, and you need a system that has real accountability. You need a system where administrators have customers, students, who if they don't serve them properly, you know, they lose business, they lose profit. What we have is a system now where there is no real accountability. You know, every couple of years...
Oh, certainly there is. There are school boards, there are PTAs.
Yeah, exactly. Every few years you can get voted off the school board, but that's not real accountability. Real accountability is when your bottom line suffers if you're not producing a proper quality.
Only if you're a for-profit institution. I mean, I'm all in favor of capitalism in a regulated, you know, form and for companies making a profit, but we're talking about the core stuff here. I mean, Thomas Jefferson founded the University of Virginia as a free publicly funded institution solely to provide social mobility in society. What you're arguing for, Keith, is a system which is going to rigidly enforce orders and classes, which I realize is John Locke's definition of, you know, what a conservative is really all about. But I just don't think that most Americans believe that that's what we want to have, where wealthy.
But do you think the public education system that we have today is doing anything to alleviate, you know, to provide a quality education to low-income students?
I think our public education system has been under assault for 26 years, ever since Reagan came into office and started trying to deconstruct it. Yes, I think that our public education
system
has
been failing long before Reagan came into power.
We have one of the highest literacy rates in the world, Keith. We had the average citizen in America is quite functional and quite literate. Yes, I realize we have...
The literacy rate in America today is approximately 65%. And 200 years ago, it was in the 90% when we had a system of basically fully private.
The problem with those statistics is that they include a lot of people who have come into this country illegally and are not conversant in English. If you've got 20 million people in this country who don't have English who aren't even largely functional in English, and you include them in your survey of who's literate and who's not, yes, you're going to have very high illiteracy standards. But and also there's the question of how do you define literacy. But broadly speaking, in the United States, the vast majority of people, I mean, how many people have you met recently who don't know how to read?
Well, hang on a minute. I think we're getting away from the basic issue here.
The schools are working. They need some help. I mean, they need a lot of help, frankly, but they're working.
All the arguments that you're making are based on the idea that society has some sort of duty or you know, stake in educating students.
Yes, absolutely.
I think I disagree with the idea that there's any sort of right to education. You know, parents have a responsibility.
It goes beyond
to
a
provide
right.
their children with an education.
It goes beyond a right, Keith. It gets to the core. I mean, and again, this is it's brilliant that we're having this conversation because it's the perfect cleavage of the conservative worldview and the liberal worldview. My argument is not that we should all have a right to an education, but that we collectively got together when this country was created. We collectively got together and said, you know, to have the kind of society that we want to have, we're going to do things like subsidize newsprint and subsidize the mailing of newspapers, which we've done from the signing of the Constitution
day. But that is not what defines the founding of the country. The founding of this country is defined by the protection of individual rights, meaning, you know, rights, freedom
in part,
from interference.
In part,
others.
The founding of this country was also founded on the idea of community, that we're all in this together, that we're looking out for each other. You know, Ben Franklin started the first fire department, the first public libraries.
Well,
these were things people got together.
Maybe that was the founding of Cuba, but that was not the founding of America.
What, Ben Franklin starting a public library is the founding of Cuba?
Look, the Declaration of Independence is based you know, the reason governments are instituted.
The Declaration of Independence is not a legal document.
Happiness. I don't see anything about the fire department in the Declaration of Independence.
Well, the Declaration of Independence is not a legal document, but that governs this country. The Constitution is, and in the preamble of the Constitution, there are six items that are explicitly listed as the goal of government in this country, and one of them is to promote the general welfare. And if promoting the general welfare means having an educated populace,
the founding fathers' concept of promoting the general welfare is not. If Thomas Jefferson was here today and looked at our public school system, he probably would burn the University of Virginia to the ground in protest.
No, he would say fund it better, like I did the University of Virginia. Give it enough money that you can hire the very best professors, give them the very best books and schools.
U.S. expenditure per student is the highest in the world, and yet our school system is still failing. 40% of fourth graders still can't read properly, and yet we're spending more money on students than any other country in the world. So how is more money going to solve the problem? The problem is not.
I have never suggested,
Keith,
that the problem is money. In fact, I would suggest to you, I agree with your criticism of No Child Left Behind. I think it's terrible. I think our education system needs a lot of overhaul. And I've written two books about this. But I disagree with your position that we should simply do away with public education because it's not optimal right now in the United States.
Well, I disagree with your disagreement.
Okay. Well, it's a reasonable place to leave it, I guess. Yeah, okay. Well, I guess that's really ultimately what it gets right down to.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately it's do you think children have a right to education or not?
Yeah.
I think parents have a moral responsibility to provide their children with an education. They don't have a responsibility to provide other people's children with an education. And if we had a system where people were responsible for their own children, they weren't taxed to the hilt to pay for other people's children, you'd have a system where you could have private schools developing with real accountability and real quality growing driven by the free market.
For the rich.
For everybody.
Well, see, that's, you know, it doesn't work that way. But.
Well, it does work that way. Do poor people, you know, are there thousands of people who can't afford shoes? Should we collectivize and nationalize the shoe industry?
No, we shouldn't. And I'll agree with you on that. Keith Lockvich, he's with Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Thanks, Keith. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Travel on, there's one day here and the next day gone. Sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand, sometimes you turn your back to the wind. There's a world outside every darkened door where blues won't haunt you anymore. Where the brave are free and lovers soar. Come ride with me to the distant shore. We won't hesitate to break down the garden gate. There's not much time left today. Yeah.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. You know, the other side of this whole argument about public schools is the whole issue of vouchers. I mean, that comes into it as well. Vouchers, you know, you've got the cons out there who are conservatives who are sort of, you know, they're not going as far as Keith is willing to go, where he's just being honest and saying, hey, you know, we just don't think you should have a public education system. And you know, I congratulate him for being forthright and upfront about it. But you've got a whole bunch of people in politics who really, that's their agenda. They just know that it's politically unpopular to say it, so they're not going to say it out loud. So instead, what they're trying to do is destroy the public education system. And one of the ways that they want to destroy it is with vouchers. Oh, yeah, let's create competition. That's what we need. We need competition. Or it's all the union's fault. That's another one of the favorite ones of the people who hate unions. Right? Oh, it's those teachers' unions, huh? They're terrible. They're just, you know, bringing about disaster. I mean, who was it? Neil Bortz, I think, the other day said, you know, teachers' unions are more destructive to America than Al-Qaeda. And, you know, I've written two books at least that touch very, very heavily, one in considerable detail on the history of public education in the United States. I'm well aware of the flaws of public education. I'm on the board of directors of a school for kids with ADHD, a private school in New Hampshire. I mean, I'm familiar with these issues. And yet, at the same time, I get it that without public education, Without you know, a good public education system, we're not going to have the ability in the United States to have the kind of social mobility that is necessary for there to be a middle class and that is necessary, frankly, for there to be democracy. When you have a rigidly stratified society where only the wealthy can afford to get a good education for their kids and the poor have to take whatever, you know, whatever's left over, if that, then you have a society where, you know, people, where despair happens, where people just can't break out of this. I worked in the slums of Bogota, in the La Paz slum, in one of the, you know, what we were doing was helping them create their own education system because the state wasn't doing it. I mean, it was a tragedy. I mean, you've got people, you know, 16, 18, 20, 25 years old who literally don't know how to read. How are they ever going to do anything? And so you end up with gang violence and you end up with drug gangs and all this, you know, other, you know, awful stuff going. Public education is at the core of our values, in my opinion, at the core of the progressive values, the historic American values of this nation. New studies indicate that American students are among the best educated in the world. By the way, I've got a fact sheet. This is from Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and they do a really nice fact sheet on private school vouchers. The U.S. has one of the highest graduation rates in the world from high school. The U.S. schools steer more students to college than does any other country, even though many of those countries weed out mediocre students. In many measures of academic achievement, the status of U.S. students with the majority educated in public schools continues to rise. Polls show that the vast majority of parents support public schools. that their children, the public schools that their children are attending, and believe those schools are doing a good job. Now, one of the other conservative arguments is, well, I don't have kids, so why should I pay to educate your kids? Well, because when my kid is educated, my kid may be the person who is your, you know, running your nursing home. You know, my kid might be the cop who is making sure that your streets are safe. I mean, my kid might be the guy, be the person who is solving the global climate crisis that could kill us all. I mean, the bottom line is that we as a society collectively have good and strong reasons to want to have a public education system that actually works, and that actually works for all of us, right across the board, for all Americans. This is not an abstraction. Now, you know, in the early days of America, communities got together and they simply did it themselves. Say, okay, you know, let's build a building and hire a school marm. And the community, and you have a little town of, you know, 50, 100, 200, 300 people, and they'd all get together, and everybody would chip in, and they'd take some of the common land, and they'd have the equivalent of a barn raising. They'd build a schoolhouse out of it, a one-room schoolhouse, and they would all get together, and they'd say, okay, we're all going to collectively tax ourselves. Everybody chips in a buck a year or whatever it is, and we bring the school teacher in from the big city. I mean, you've all seen the Westerns, right? I mean, we've always known that having community support education is a good thing for a community, both in the short term, and it's not just about, you know, getting kids off the streets or something like that, but both in the short term because you're producing productive members of society, but also in the long term. Now, are there problems with our public education system? Sure. I mean, one of my biggest arguments is that it doesn't promote critical thinking, that we have way too much emphasis on rote memorization. We need much more Socratic teaching, where students are challenged, and where teachers, frankly, are challenged. We have a school system that's basically founded on the model of the Industrial Revolution, where the kids are like, you know, items on an assembly line. And then you get these non-standard items, and they get dumped into things called special ed and things like that. You know, I have a lot of concerns about how we do it. But I think we should fix it, not throw it out. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Back 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our number 866-303-2270. There, I'm getting it memorized myself. It's a brand new phone number for us. Anyhow, welcome back. What should we do about public education? Scott in Houston, Texas, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Tom, good to talk to you as always.
Thank you.
Hey, two quick points. First of all, I agree with you. Aside from our individual rights as freedoms guaranteed in the Constitution, I think the right of an education is paramount to our society. It's the building block that makes all other things possible. So I couldn't disagree more.
Here's the problem that we have. There are two areas. One is the right to be educated. The other is the right to have health care. That are not rights. They're not defined as rights by law at this current moment. We haven't had Supreme Court decisions that have decided that they're rights. They're not explicitly laid out in the Constitution. Although you could argue that they fall under the purview of, you know, the public welfare that's in the preamble of the Constitution. And so I'm frankly of the opinion that what we should be pushing our legislators to do is to write a law or perhaps even a constitutional amendment that says that education and health care are rights, not privileges, in the United States, as is the case in most every fully industrialized and developed country in the world. I think it's just, you know, very straightforward, just lay it out. Scott, you nailed it. Thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. Raymond in Plattsburgh, New York, listening to WTWK. Hey, Raymond.
Hello again. Wasn't it not Jefferson who stated that part of the creation of a democracy depended upon an educated
populace? Yes.
And also, as a retired teacher, I'm probably going to be hanged for heresy for this one, but one of my beliefs is that having traveled the world and having seen various education systems, it seems that every other country except ours has a unified national curriculum that seems to work for them. It makes it so much easier because one student can go from one township to another township, and they are traveling. They walk into the classroom. They're in the same spot. They're in the same place.
Yeah.
In the same curriculum.
I don't disagree that it's a good idea to have some basic minimum standards. You know, are you, if you are educated, it means that you understand math to this level, that you understand history to this level, that you are able to read at this level, that there should be some certain minimum standards. I'm very wary, however, of this No Child Left Behind approach of, if you can memorize this test, then we consider you educated.
Oh, I don't want that kind of thing because that is just creating, not just a No Child Left Behind, it's more of a Every Child Left Behind standard.
And that's
that just creates more excuses for corporate America to dig in and publish more books for no reason at all.
Well said. Raymond, thanks for the call, and thanks for your service as a teacher to our country. Phil in Sherman Oaks, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? I'm really tossed up on this issue because I come from two distinct perspectives. On the one hand, I benefited from an amazing progressive public education in Brooklyn, New York in the late 50s, early 60s, early 60s. And we had advanced math and science and language and all this in the elementary school level and amazing teachers. It was really spectacular. So I see this as the public education as the greatest example of opportunity that we can provide people in the country, opportunity for this American dream, more than health care, more than housing, more than anything else the government can dish out. If the government can dish this one out to everybody, then anybody from any background can really rise up and can understand. And plus, it preserves the democracy. I understand how important it is.
Right.
On the other hand, I've spent the last 6 or 7 years of my life as a high-priced consultant into government agencies, and I've been in the bowels of this stuff. And I don't know if you've ever seen it firsthand.
I have. I've written 7 books on attention deficit disorder, and 2 of them more broadly on learning disorders. And I did spend and like I said, I've for what 10, 12 years now, I've been on the board of a private school, and for several years I did consulting work for schools, including big city schools like Atlanta, and smaller ones like Muskegon, Michigan. You know, where I came in and I trained teachers mostly, or did programs on how do you deal with kids specifically with ADHD by and large. But yes, I understand it. And at the federal level, in particular, the Department of Education is very ineffective or inefficient. And I think that there needs to be a lot more local control. And I think that there needs to be a broader base of funding. The fact that we're funding most of our public school systems simply with property taxes is a real tough one.
Agreed.
And I think that those, you know, if we can come up with that right mix of enough local control that the local communities are involved and really feel like they're stakeholders in education, and enough state and federal support that local communities, particularly smaller or less affluent communities, don't get wiped out,
right,
so that there's some leveling, that's the optimal situation.
The people that are willing to put up the money, that have their hands on the money, they don't want to let go of the measure of control that they have.
Yeah.
But the more control that they have, from what I've seen, because I was in the DOE and social services and also the Department of Justice at a very, very high level, and I met all the executives and all the managers, and there's astonishing layers of inefficiency.
Sure. Yeah, you have empire building going on inside some of these agencies.
Horrific, and it saps all the life out of the program.
Yep. No, I get it, and I agree with you. And that's where, you know, we need to be more outspoken. We need to be taking our government back. We need to be taking our institutions back. Phil, thank you for the call. I think it's really important that we do that. And that we'd be speaking out about this. You know, this is the issue that caused our congressman or our senator from Vermont, when I lived in Vermont, to leave the Republican Party. You know, Jim said, "That's it, I'm out of here." Devron in Seattle. Hey, Devron, what's up?
Hey,
listening on KPTK.
You're a real big support backbone for us out here because, before I go to my point, I mean, it just gets hard to stay focused out here when, you know, you think that everything's coming to an end and you're like, hold up, this is a democracy here, we can fix this, we can work this out, people.
We've been through worse. We had a civil war once, you know, we've been through worse, trust me.
Okay, but yes, I agree. I told your person that answers the calls, the screener, that I kind of agree with the guy in the sense that I don't want to drop public education, but I mean, there's some things here that when we start with education, we have to think about, you know, where are these people coming from? What's it like when they leave the school? You know, what are they going home to the families that are wealthy and, you know, lots of iPods and, you know, television? Are they going home to bare cupboards and, you know, or basically, you know, when they get out of school or go to school, it's like the teachers are babysitters because, you know, the kids, at least in the urban, you know, I know it's a little different in the rural areas, but right here in the center of the city, it's a battle. These kids are fighting when they get out of school.
Oh, absolutely. But see, Devron, that takes us back to the other issue, which is, you know, do we have the right to a living wage? I mean, this is what Teddy Roosevelt back in 1906, 1907 was talking about, that if you put in your 40 hours, if you play by the rules of the game and you put in an honest 40 hours, you should be able to put your kids through school and have your health care provided for and know that you can actually buy a home and that you can save enough for a decent retirement. Teddy Roosevelt's definition of the middle class. And, you know, this 26-year assault by conservatives, starting with Reagan, on the American middle class is ripping apart our society.
And we definitely need to take more of a, you know, personal interest in people who don't have children need to be concerned, like you said, and, you know, people who do have children. Because, I mean, just simple knowledge of washing your hands daily can keep colds, you know.
Oh, yeah. This is there's just all kinds of fundamental stuff, not to mention the fact that it would be nice to have a few rocket scientists coming out of our schools.
Thanks.
Devron,
keep up the power.
Okay, you too. Yeah, thanks a lot, Devron. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Dan in Northampton, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm good.
I just want to start off by saying thank you for your show. It's wonderful to have such an intelligent, thoughtful show where people can express differences of opinion without being shouted down and had epithets hurled at them. So thank you very much for the service you provide to us.
You're welcome. Thank you for your kind words.
Two points I'd like to make. Like your previous caller, Phil, I sort of come from two different perspectives. I was educated in the private school system for 12 years. But my wife has been a public school educator for the past 20 years, and so I've seen both sides of the fence.
Sure.
And every time I hear someone like the gentleman from the Ayn Rand Institute saying that our public schools are broken or they're not working, the first question I want to ask someone like that is, how much time have you spent inside of a public school observing hardworking, highly educated, incredibly motivated public school teachers?
Yeah.
You know?
And not just observing, occasionally helping out.
That's right. Get in there and get your hands dirty.
Yeah.
Let's find out if these schools aren't working. I think the real issue is, Tom, is we're dealing with a societal issue with a lot of our children. And unfortunately, we can't point a finger at their parents and blame them for not putting them into bed on time, not giving them proper meals, not making sure the homework is done. And so the only scapegoat we have is the school system itself.
Yeah. And you're right, Dan, and that brings us once again back to Teddy Roosevelt and this whole idea of, gee, how about the idea of a middle class? How about the idea that, you know, corporate profits could be a little lower and taxes might be a little higher on billionaires, but the product of that would be a middle class, a healthy and strong middle class, and the consequence of that would be that life would actually be better in this country for the millionaires and billionaires as well as for everybody else, that we all benefit. That it's not just the Reaganist notion that if the people at the very top do well, something will trickle down to everybody else, but rather that if we can make sure that there's a minimum threshold, that the government is a backstop at a certain level, not a support system. You know, I don't think anybody here is saying let's go to a welfare state. You know, let's replicate the Soviet Union or something. But if it can just be a minimum threshold where we can make sure that people's minimum needs are met, we do not have that in the United States right now. Dan, thank
you, brother.
Yeah, thank you. They do in Sweden. You know, they do in Finland. They do in Norway. Norway is the most literate country in the world. But we don't have that in the United States right now. And in my opinion, it's because we have not yet put into law the belief that education and health care are rights, not privileges. 45 minutes past them.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. have a silly notion if we want them to be friends. They prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
Yes, indeed.
Unforgivable.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. The radio support group of by and for We the People, the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Program. Marcus in Yorba Linda, California. Welcome to the show.
Well, good morning, sir. And I'd like to say that if you read the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto regarding open borders, legalized drugs, elimination of private property, and subsidized public education.
To the best of my knowledge, none of those things are in the Communist Manifesto.
Well, it's been
30 years since I read it, but no.
Well,
sorry.
You're
talking about Marx and Engels?
Yes. And the point.
Are you trying to tell me that you've actually read the Communist? I mean, it's only about 35 pages long. You've read the Communist Manifesto, and you think that it says legalized drugs is in there?
Yes. And I just want to tell you that subsidized public education is not from our forefathers. It's not from this country. It comes out of the Soviet system. And like Reverend Dan said, you're a communist fornicator.
Okay, so you're suggesting... Oh, you hung up on me. Oh, well. He's suggesting that Jefferson didn't actually create the University of Virginia, and it's not actually on his tombstone that he was so proud of it that he did that. Oh, man. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, great to come on the heels of that caller. I don't know if that's...
Well, you know, I think it's this probably the same spoof guy, you know. I don't know.
Right.
Sometimes these, you know. Anyway,
yeah.
Tom, what's up?
They also called Franklin Roosevelt a communist, and they still do.
Sure.
And you don't have to go as far back as Teddy Roosevelt or even Thomas Jefferson. You can come up to the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt and talk about his second Bill of Rights, that most famous speech in 1944, where he lists all these rights that almost were enacted. And dare these guys to criticize Franklin Roosevelt, dare them to mock him, dare them to call him.
And you know what Roosevelt did that was so brilliant was he called out an entire generation and said, get active. And this is what John Edwards is doing that I applaud him for. And this is not a naked endorsement of John Edwards. I just think I'm not hearing any other politician say it, and I wish all of them would be saying it. But Franklin Roosevelt came right out and said,
there is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
And, I mean, he just nailed it down, and what happened was the entire generation said, yeah!
Yeah, and he went after what he called the economic royalists, and these Ayn Rand guys want to make, they don't like that capitalism is subservient to our system of governance of democracy.
Right.
They hate that.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line. It's not just the Ayn Rand guys. This is the whole conservative worldview is that somehow they think that capitalism is a political system, and it's not. It's an economic system. We live in a democratic republic. We don't, you know, we happen to have regulated capitalism here, but it is not a political system.
Right.
Tom, thanks for the call. I got to move along, but I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Steve in Mountain View, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Tom. I grew up in Michigan, and they had an excellent public education system.
Yeah, me too.
At that time. My father has a doctor's degree in education. He's a principal and a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
The point I wanted to make is it's not really about public education. That's kind of the tip of the iceberg. It's about community. It's about the commons. People who think that that public education is irrelevant to them or is not part of their world are just simply not paying attention to the fact that they live in a world in which most of the people that are doing the services that they're consuming are in fact educated in a public education system.
That's right. That's right. And we wouldn't be able to have businesses wouldn't be able to function in this country if we didn't have.
Well, it's interesting that. Three of the CEOs, for example, I work here. I'm a high tech engineer in Silicon Valley. Three of the most successful CEOs in the history of high tech, including Scott McNeely of Sun Microsystems and Joe Costello of Cadence,
mm-hmm.
were products of the public education system in Michigan.
That's interesting. Whereas, if you look at the Fortune 500, you find that virtually all of their CEOs were, you know, born into wealth and went to private schools. And it's almost like there's an oligarchy forming that's been forming in this country. It probably has been, you know, well, not probably. There has been kind of an undercurrent of oligarchy ever since the 1880s, you know, with the emergence of the robber barons. but it's really gotten conspicuous in the last 25, 30 years. And frankly, this assault on public education, I think, is an attempt to even strengthen it. Steve, I got to move along. Thanks for the call, though. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Jeff in Richmond, California. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. Real quick, I just wanted to say my wife worked as an AmeriCorps volunteer in Springfield, Oregon, many years ago in one of the public schools there.
Mm-hmm.
She's a self-described socialist. At least she said that. She's a registered green and all that.
Sure.
She's even come around to the idea of vouchers and school choice because she had an experience of working with a very bad teacher who just the school administration was just up in arms about.
Yeah.
It took them apparently a couple years to fire. And
Jeff, if vouchers were not tied in any way to specific monetary amounts, then I would have much less problem with them than I have. But all the voucher proposals that I've seen across, on average in the United States, around $5,600 a year to educate a child in public school systems. Obviously, it varies from community to community, but that's the average. The vast majority of voucher programs that have been proposed as legislation offer anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000 a year. And now, why would they do that? Because basically these are subsidies for people who are wealthy enough to already put their kids in private schools. And so, hey, we're going to give you a little extra for your private school. And then the public schools become the dumping grounds, literally the dumping grounds, for those kids whose parents can't afford the extra $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 a year to pay for even a basic minimal education. And then once those public schools are really failing badly, the cons, like the, Ayn Rand guys, they get on and they say, see, we told you. Doesn't work.
Well, Tom, what about the proposals that target vouchers simply to low-income parents and students and, eliminate all people over a certain income range?
Well, then what you're doing is you're creating a means-tested system, a welfare system, and means-tested systems are welfare systems, which is why Social Security should never be means-tested, for example. Once you put those into place, they become the first targets of any political action. Even Bill Clinton, we're going to do away with welfare as we know it. And no, I am totally opposed to any kinds of means tested programs like that because they will be hacked apart. 57 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Let me just take this a step farther. We started out talking about public schools and the conservative notion that public schools, frankly, shouldn't even exist. That it should all be about private schools. Let's let Chris Whittle educate everybody with TV or something. Let's give out vouchers. So that it's all private school all the time. And eventually let's do away with the vouchers because after all, that's paid for with tax dollars. And after all, tax dollars, that's men with guns coming to your house taking money from you. What? Social contract? I didn't sign no stinking social contract. That's the argument on the right. But the American way, the way that we have always looked at this is we have said, collectively, we're all in this together. And yes, America has acted out many of these things, many of the values, many of the core liberal values of the Enlightenment that led to the founding of this country. We've acted out many of those values imperfectly. In fact, frankly, quite poorly. Slavery, for example. The inability of women to fully participate in society for the majority of the history of this country. And to this day, still we have the remnants of both those institutions. Okay, so, yes, we have not always been perfect, but there is this profound difference in worldview that needs to be, I was going to say exposed, but it's not like it's a secret. It needs to be discussed, frankly, in my opinion. And that is the conservative notion that business will solve everything if we just leave it to business. Versus the idea that we, the people, collectively get together from time to time and create institutions to make sure that we, the people, collectively are safe and can have social mobility and that there is some positive outcome to our future. And that the main institution that we do that through is called government. And that in the United States, what makes our government so different from the Soviet government, for example, is that in the United States, our government is us. We own the government. So, for example, when Richard Nixon and Jack Kennedy were debating in 1960, the issue came up, what do you do about the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision? Now, keep in mind, in 1954, Eisenhower was president and Richard Nixon was vice president. And so, you know, the question, you know, we still have segregation in the United States. What are you going to do about it? And Nixon answered the question by saying, essentially, this is a moral wrong. Yes, I agree. It's a terrible thing. And the solution is to go to industry and beg them to fix the problem. Here's Richard Nixon in the 1960 debate responding to, you know, why his administration, why the Eisenhower administration had taken 6 years to begin implementing Brown versus Board of Education. And in the broader sense, like the desegregation of the dime stores, and public facilities.
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola. This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do we do? Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
That was Nixon's answer, in its entirety, by the way. Call in the owners of the chain stores and ask them to do something, please. And, you know, obviously it didn't work. I mean, this was the 1960 election. It was the height of the civil rights movement. It was 5, 6, 7 years later, although it was going on at the time. So Kennedy then, in rebuttal, they say, okay, Senator, what do you think about this? And he then takes it from education to the much and segregation in education, which is what the 1954 Brown v. Board of Education case was all about, to the much larger issue of, are we all in this together, or do we just, you know, ask the owners of the chain stores to be nice? Jack Kennedy.
Senator Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions.
So, and here we get right to it.
What is going to be done, and what would be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. He's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country.
See, and now Kennedy has expanded it out. He said, you know, you can't have functional school systems when you have families who are working full-time and still can't have a middle-class lifestyle. They can't provide the basic substrate that's necessary for their family to succeed. And he goes on to talk about this and how in our society there is that cleavage by race. And it was very, very clear in 1960. And it unfortunately is still there. It's not as bad as it was, but it's still there and it still needs work. But Kennedy just coming right out and saying, here's the issue.
So that everyone can get a job regardless of their race or color. Nor has he indicated that he will support Title III, which would give the Attorney General additional powers to protect constitutional rights. These are the great questions. Equality of education in school. About 2% of our population.
And then he, you know, Jack Kennedy then gets into all the details, as it were, you know, of how it's all working out and saying, you know, we need to do something about this. And so, anyhow, I wanted to share that with you, bring that back around. Tony Snow now claims, by the way, Tony Snow is now saying that what he said yesterday, he didn't mean to say what he said. During yesterday's White House briefing, this is from the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org, Tony Snow tried to play down the neglect uncovered at Walter Reed by portraying it as old news. He says, President Bush has certainly been aware of the conditions in the wards where he has visited. Yeah. This is in the Washington Post. Dana Priest co-authored a piece where they discovered just these absolutely horrific conditions. And so now they're saying that George Bush first learned of the troubling allegations regarding Walter Reed from the stories this weekend in the Washington Post, and that he's deeply concerned. And meanwhile, and this, how does this happen, right? John McCain calls out Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld. to begin with.
Republican presidential candidate John McCain recently lashed out at Cheney and his friend, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Today, Cheney fired back.
And, so today, Cheney goes on ABC TV, Good Morning America, and they ask him about it. Here's the questioner, John, I'm not sure the guy's name, but whoever it was who was asking him this on Good Morning America, says, tell us about this thing. You know, Cheney, John McCain says that Don Rumsfeld was the worst Secretary of Defense ever, and that you're a pretty lousy vice president, you know, this whole war in Iraq thing. And what about it?
John McCain again came out to say that your friend Don Rumsfeld is perhaps the worst Secretary of Defense ever. What do you make of that?
Here's Cheney.
I disagree with John. John said some nasty things about me the other day, and then next time he saw me, ran over to me and apologized. Maybe he'll apologize to Rumsfeld.
He said some nasty things about me the other day, and then the next time he saw me, he ran over to apologize. I'm telling you, it's tragic to watch John McCain implode. It is absolutely tragic. Also in the news today, this is, I think, probably one of the most interesting things, is Tony Blair's announcement that he's going to cut UK troop levels. And, you know, some interesting questions that this raises. He's going to reduce the level of UK troops in Iraq. Is it, number one, that, you know, Prince Harry wants to go to Iraq and Tony Blair says, not on my watch, we're going to cut back on the force. Could that be? No, frankly, I don't think that that's his motivation. Could it be that things are actually wonderful and secure and stable in the south of Iraq and he figures we don't need to have the soldiers there anymore? I don't think so. I mean, yes, they're far more stable than they are in Baghdad. This is a almost purely ethnic Shia area, and the Shia are not the ones, you know, they've been responsible for maybe 7-8% of the attacks on Americans. Mostly it's been Sunnis with funding from Saudi Arabia. So this is, you know, a Shia area that might be friendly to Iran, for example. And they're, you know, it's not so hot, but still, you know, there's problems in this country, and they're getting increasingly unhappy about being occupied. Or could it be that Tony Blair sees coming down the road that George W. Bush is soon going to be launching missiles into Iran? Is there another Downing Street memo circulating at 10 Downing Street right now that says that they're preparing to fix the intelligence to match the policy? And he wants to get his soldiers out of the way before those bombs start falling. Frankly, that's the one that makes the most sense to me. Denmark, by the way, is also pulling out 460 of their troops. They're following Britain's lead. They're, you know, countries around the world are saying enough already. Enough. We're not going to have any more of this. And at the same time, you know, Bush, he's got a mighty victory going. 16 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls in just a minute.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. If I have that right, Lauren, I do. I do. Indeed. 21 minutes past the hour. And David in Sebastopol, California on the line. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, you know, the caller who said he was from the Ayn Rand Institute.
Yeah, he was actually our guest in the first hour.
Your guest, sorry. Mentioned a couple of times that during the colonial period, the literacy rates in America were almost 100%.
Yeah, they were very high. I mean, that's the essence of de Tocqueville's Democracy in America.
But he failed to mention that when they counted people, they certainly didn't count slaves. They didn't count non-citizens. Mm-hmm. They probably didn't count people who were not property owners,
right.
And they probably didn't count women.
And they didn't count recent immigrants, and there were a lot, you know, there's been a continuous stream of recent
immigrants. Yeah, any non-citizens,
yeah,
sure.
Right.
So,
yeah,
so the statistics are wildly skewed.
Yeah.
The other thing about No Child Left Behind, and this is also a call for public action, in the mathematics of No Child Left Behind, if it's reauthorized this year without any changes, eventually all schools will be classified as underperforming.
Yeah, because of the
mathematics that's just built into it.
Right.
And
it's a system
and that will
progressively gets worse and worse and worse. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the whole point. In Jim Jeffords' mind, the reason why he left the Republican Party was because of No Child Left Behind. And in his opinion, and he was pretty outspoken about this, it was an attempt to destroy public education gradually.
It has to be true.
Yeah, and just like the Part D of Medicare, the prescription drug benefit where you can't negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies, was an attempt to destroy Medicare. It was a poison pill. They put that in there thinking that over time it would bankrupt it, just like they said thought that No Child Left Behind not only would make, you know, the other thing that No Child Left Behind, and David, thank you for the call, the other thing that No Child Left Behind did was it turned a multi-million dollar a year industry into a multi-billion dollar a year industry, and that's the testing industry. You know, which were strong lobbyists for this. And Neil Bush, of course, is, you know, now making his money in the testing industry. Gee, what a surprise. Steve in Wisconsin on the line. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I am a long-time listener, first-time caller. I am a huge admirer of your work.
Thank you.
I am from Pennsylvania, and it always gets me a little bit amused when people talk about communism.
You said you're from Transylvania.
I grew up in under communist Romania under Ceausescu. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I'm sick and tired, for instance, for one thing, that people always talk about Dracula when it comes to Transylvania.
Yeah.
Because we have a long history of progressive communities in a very oppressive society.
You're right.
I wanted to offer hope to your listeners that maybe Bush is trying his best, but I see the panic in the American elite and aristocracy, and they will not succeed. And here is why. And this is what I wanted to mention first. I wanted to talk about the 1989 revolution in Timișoara, where I was a mechanical engineering student in December 1989. They tried to arrest Reverend Laszlo Tőkés, was speaking up for minority rights, especially education,
mm-hmm.
and also against the power of abuse of power.
In which country was this? Did you say Kinshasa? Where was this? The revolution?
In Timișoara, Romania.
Oh, in Romania. Okay,
that's where the whole thing started.
Timișoara is
in Transylvania.
Right.
And they couldn't arrest him because 2,000 of my colleagues on campus, he was actually the campus minister for ReformEd, for one of the Protestant sects there. And they couldn't arrest him because of citizens and students encircled his home, and that's where the whole thing started, the revolution. That's where all of a sudden, overnight, you had 500,000 people on the street.
I think you could argue, Steve, that's what brought down Nixon as well. I mean, the tip of the iceberg was Watergate, but frankly, I don't think that Watergate would have been the big deal that it was or would have been played out exactly the way it was if you didn't have kids getting shot on college campuses and massive demonstrations across the country, people figuring out that Nixon had been lying to us about his secret plan to end the war. I mean, it started with basically middle-class students.
Yes, and if I can mention one thing, is that if he wants powers over the military to use it against the Posse Comitatus, we should worry about it, but let him do it, okay? Because that's what brought Ceausescu down, because his military commanders were all against shooting Romanian citizens, and he even executed the top commander, who's a great Romanian hero right now. But it didn't help because the Securitate, the political police, which was basically a light infantry, mechanized infantry unit, they were overwhelmed by the
Steve,
power.
Steve, we're out of time, but I absolutely agree with you that ultimately democracy wins out or something similar to it. The problem, you know, is obviously we don't want to end up with a situation like you guys had there in Romania with Ceausescu where there has to be a revolution, essentially. It would be nice to just put posse comitatus back into place. But good point, and thank you for the call, Steve. It's much appreciated. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. The real free speech zone. No barbed wire. We won't haul your car away if it has a no blood for oil bumper sticker. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. And welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartman program, 34 minutes past the hour. TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, you can also get there through AirAmericaRadio.com. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Vicki in Sacramento, California. Hey, Vicki, what's up?
Well, I'm a second-time caller. You used to be on our other station, and I'm glad you're on here. I was a school nurse for 16 years, was at individual schools, but also I was a child abuse prevention nurse for our 50,000-student district. And our idea as school nurses is that each individual student needs help. And what we could do is use this testing that is, you know, messing things up, but use it to help individual students rather than focusing on individual schools. And here's my reason. Those students who need the most help and whose parents are unable to provide it often move. Mm-hmm. And so when you are looking at what's happening from year to year at an individual school, you're looking at different students.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so there's a need for use of some sort of testing, at least, to identify special needs kids so that you can help them.
Well, not the special needs kids. That's already taken care of. I'm talking about students who are regular education students in the classroom, but who aren't making it because the other students who are making it have parents who are able to help them. Our idea was that those students who need the help could have a mentor,
right,
who would kind of be the in locus parent, during the school
parental
hour.
Absolutely. Mentoring is an incredibly useful and powerful and positive thing. That's great, Vicki, and I salute you for working in our public schools. I've got to move along, but thank you very much for the call. This is, with thanks to Robert who sent me this note, this is the quote from Thomas Jefferson. Educate and inform the whole mass of the people. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. There you go. Anthony in Tenafly, New Jersey, listening on WWRL. Hey, Anthony, what's on your mind today?
It's Andrew.
Andrew, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I want to make a comment about that key from RAND Corporation.
Mm-hmm. It's the Ayn Rand Institute, actually.
It's
a nonprofit.
I was educated in that kind of system he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why in third world countries 70% of people go to these private schools is because the public schools are so bad. They use textbooks that are 20, 30 years old.
Right, because they've become dumping grounds because the equivalent of how a voucher system would play out has basically created a two-tiered school system. You've got the private schools
It's funny that they never mentioned comparing a school system that we should set our eyes on Scandinavian countries.
Right.
Why do we set our sights on third world countries?
Yeah, that was my point. And Norway has the highest literacy rate in the world, you know, and the highest number of books read per person, per adult in the world and all that. Why don't we be looking at their school system? Well, everybody goes, well, but that's a socialist country. If you mean like the old Soviet Union socialism, but yeah, if you mean like democratic socialism, yes, a good point. Andrew, thank you very much. Pat in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Pat.
Hi. Boy, listen, I was so upset after hearing that man. I had turned it off. I was just yelling at the radio.
I'm sorry. I'm glad you turned it back on.
I've been in the classroom for, I'm a retired teacher now. I was in the classroom for 25 years, and I just have two comments. You cannot take our school system and compare it with any other country. We educate everybody. I don't care if it's a spina bifida kid. I don't care if it's they have autism. I don't care what their problem is. We educate everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just cannot, you can't compare.
Well, there's a number of European countries that do the same.
I'm
sorry? There's a number of European countries that do the same. I know from having done, teaching and consulting work in Germany and in England, in the United Kingdom, that's the case in those countries. I'm assuming most of the rest of Europe.
Yeah, frequently they're comparing us with Japan. And there, it's a whole different mindset there. And the other thing is, back to our founding fathers, another gentleman referred to it. We have educated people so that we can have informed voters.
Yeah. Amen. 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 Well said, Pat. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I appreciate the call. Bye now. Yeah, Will in South Park, Colorado. Hey, Will, what's on your mind?
Hello. How you doing, man?
I'm great. What's up?
I just wanted to go real quick. I heard last week or sometime around then, W wrote in somewhere that he can use our troops against us.
It got written into the military appropriations bill that was passed by the House and Senate in September and Bush signed in October. Did away with posse comitatus,
right.
and then the final nail in the coffin was the Military Commissions Act, which was about the same period of time. It was in October of last year, which did away with habeas corpus pretty much altogether. So he can not only use our troops against us, he can also put us in prison forever without ever charging us with anything.
Do you think maybe the uneducation of America to fill up the military might have something to do with what they've got on the program here for us? Or?
As I've said many times on this program, the war on public education that began with Ronald Reagan, when Reagan came in and started promoting this conservative worldview and began overtly the war on public education, in part because, or at least it was rationalized as a war against teachers' unions, God forbid, but also it was a war on public education, has caused us to has caused an entire generation, frankly, not to know the foundations of this country and the basic baseline understandings of how American democracy works, and that's one of the things that is allowing Bush to get away with this kind of stuff. And it's not just Bush. I mean, you've got people in Congress standing up and saying this. Will, thanks for the call, but I mean, you've got people in Congress who are coming out and saying habeas corpus. There's no habeas. I mean, you've got the Attorney General testifying before the Senate, testifying in front of Pat Leahy, saying, or no, it was our own Specter who was testifying in front of it. He says, the Constitution doesn't grant the right of habeas corpus. Well, the Constitution doesn't grant any rights. What the Constitution does is it limits the powers of government. The reason the Constitution doesn't grant any rights is because the first three words of the Constitution, we the people, make it very clear that all the rights are held by we the people. And in fact, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments to the Constitution, just to amplify that point, say any privileges or powers not taken by government in this Constitution, we don't have any right to. The government doesn't have any right to, because they automatically revert either to the states if they're governmental powers or to the people. Period. End of discussion. And it's like, it's amazing how the Attorney General of the United States doesn't understand this. That's mind-boggling. Coach Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Tom. Just a comment about the difference between the unified educational system in the UK and the US. My wife's doing a PhD at the University of Edinburgh on that topic because they're so interested. And she was just shocked by the individual crazy stuff that can happen here, where you get a Kansas a school board taken over by right-wingers who question evolution in every class and are laughingstock of the world. You get, if there's a problem in a unified system, it shows up system-wide, so it's not so easily skipped over. There are just lots of advantages to having one system for everybody.
There are, but on the other hand, most European countries are the size of a state in the United States, and at least geographically. And therefore, I mean, because the United States is so large, and because it's hard for us to have a national discussion, frankly, about things like education, I think I still believe that there needs to be a high level of local control and local participation.
Well, it'll be interesting, and I'll let you know what her research turns up in her PhD.
Okay, do that. Thanks a lot, Glenn. Appreciate it. Julie in Greenville, South Carolina. Hey, Julie.
Hi. I'm calling in response to your first guest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people who actually benefited from a public education in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And
And I benefited from a public education in Lansing, Michigan. So, you know, here we are.
Yeah. Before the 80s, of course, yeah. Yes. So he's trying to generate all this outrage against spending tax dollars on education.
Mm-hmm.
And what about all the tax dollars that get wasted on things like subsidizing ExxonMobil and
subsidizing
and Oliver,
all of the war manufacturers, yeah.
Yeah, there's. I mean, when you think about what percentage of our tax dollars would be required for these social programs, and you compare that to what we're just wasting,
yeah,
it amazes me.
Corporate welfare vastly outstrips human welfare in the United States. I mean, those programs that are at least means tested. I agree with you, Julie, and I think that we need to be spending more on education, frankly, in the United States, and doing it smarter. We need to do both. And people say, oh no, you can't throw money at a problem. And thank you for the call, Julie. And all those people who say, oh, you can't solve a problem by throwing money at it. I would say to them, fine, give me your paycheck then. You know, you won't have, you know, if you can't solve your problems with throwing money at it, you know, come on, give me a break. Ann in Mississippi. Hey, Ann, we just have about 30 seconds before we have to take a break.
Hi, I benefited from my education in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. but I just returned home from Belgium, and while we were over there, my husband got sick. He took a test. It cost him $325. We came back here, took the same test. We had a copay of $1,500. I believe the American person, the normal person, is just being ripped off in every area, education, finance, everything.
Yeah.
And they're trying to make us a third world country. Bush said he's for the haves and the have-mores. So the have-lesses better wake up. Thank you.
Yeah, well said, Ann. Well said. And he actually did that. You know, he did a black tie fundraiser. He's sitting there with a bunch of millionaires and billionaires. And, you know, he says, some call you the elite. I call you my base, you know. Amazing. 45 minutes past the hour. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. I'm Tom Hartman with you. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Escape the Matrix. Air America Radio, the Tom Hartman Program, 9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our number, airamericaradio.com, the website, and you can click through to tomhartman.com if you want and drop into our live chat room and say hi. I'm hanging out there during the breaks and some great folks in there. Dixie in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dixie, welcome to the program.
Yeah, my worry about having these voucher things, school, private schools and stuff,
mm-hmm.
is that the Constitution protects between church and state. This is a great vehicle for them to push their dominionist religion on.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, it's the religious, particularly the dominionists, who are some of the most outspoken advocates of vouchers for schools, because they want to be using tax dollars to pay for religious education. You're absolutely right. And it's
our own madrasas and the people to go to their crusades.
Yeah, you're right. And I should have pointed that out earlier. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. Well said, Dixie. Well said. Matt in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Matt.
Hey. I really enjoy your show, and everything that you say, usually I can agree with.
But!
There's one But yeah, there's a big but in there. There's one term that you use quite frequently that I just cannot agree with.
Okay.
And that's referring to our government as democracy.
All right. Why is that?
Well, you should know what a democracy is. That's where 51% of the people make the rules for 49% of the people. That's not what America is about.
Well, when was the last time that we had a presidential candidate who didn't win with a majority of the vote? I mean, isn't that how we elect our officials? Whoever gets the most votes wins? Isn't that what you're talking about?
That's, ultimately, that may be the case, but it's not.
So how are we not a democracy if we don't elect people by majority rule?
Because we're not supposed to be electing people by majority rule. Sure we are.
We're a democracy.
Our representatives are supposed to be elected among the mass of the people.
By the majority of the mass of the people. That's democracy. I will agree with you, Matt, at the if you want to put a super fine point on this, that what we live in is actually technically a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. If you want to be absolutely right about it. No, it really is. It's a constitutionally limited republic that has democratic elements and that uses representative government rather than pure democracy. In other words, the Greeks had pure democracy. You had to have 6,001 people show up in order to pass a law. And we have representative democracy, you know, where we elect people and then But the big thing here is that back about 20 years ago or so, Newt Gingrich got on his high horse and him and Frank Luntz and the whole let's figure out the language thing crowd and said, you know, democracy sounds too much like Democratic Party. And so we want to get this meme out here that we don't live in a democracy because that sounds too much like Democratic. We live in a republic because that sounds like Republican. And you know, they started promoting that and they were using, frankly, they were using James Madison's writings from the Federalist Papers back when Madison, and Matt, I'm sorry, your car, the noise from your car is coming through. So I'm just going to finish this. Thanks for the call without you on. But Madison, when he was trying to sell the Constitution, him and Hamilton, by and large, there were a few other participants in the Federalist Papers. They wrote a series of newspaper articles in which they were, you know, hustling the Constitution. You know, this is 1787, 1788, and it was ultimately ratified in 1789. And in the Federalist Papers, and I forget which one, I think it's 14 or 24, James Madison, very intentionally, and there's a brilliant book by Robert Dahl about this called How Democratic is the U.S. Constitution? And he goes back and he has Madison's writings and Madison's quotes and his letters and all this stuff. And he lays this out. Madison very, very brilliantly defined a difference between democracy and a republic for the purposes of selling the Constitution. Because prior to that time, prior to 1787, by and large, the words were interchangeable. I mean, there were some scholars who would put a fine point on them, but they were mostly interchangeable. And so he said, well, you know, democracy's mob rule. We don't want that. And really what he was doing was he was saying, we don't want to operate under the Articles of Confederation because that's too close to a pure democracy. There's just not, you know, there's not a strong enough government. There's not enough representation. There's not, you know, the rights of government are not narrowly enough and tightly enough circumscribed. And so therefore we're going to become a republic. And for about a 30-year period from the 1780s, from the late 1780s, to around 1810, 1820, 30, 40-year period there, one generation basically, or a generation and a half, during that period of time, it was very unfashionable to refer to America as a democracy. In fact, the party that Thomas Jefferson formed, and Madison was a part of and was elected as president after Jefferson left the presidency on, was called the Democratic Republican Party. But it was democratic. But then later, and then in the 1820s, they dropped the word Republican from their name because we started referring to America as a democracy again. And in the 1820s, after Madison had retired as president, in his papers, in his notes, he points out that he made that distinction back in 1787 just to help hustle the Constitution. And that in his opinion, America is a democracy. And in fact, Robert Dahl ends his book, How Democratic is the American Constitution, with a whole chapter about how, you know, I think that maybe the last sentence of the book, it's been 3 or 4 years since I read it, was one of my recommended BuzzFlash books of the month over at BuzzFlash.com. I think he ends the chapter by saying, Madison, the Republican, had become a Democrat, or the advocacy of Republicanism had become an advocacy of democracy or something like that, words to that effect. But So understand, when you hear these talking points coming out of the Republicans, by and large, about, you know, we live in a republic, not a democracy. It is, you know, as I said, arguably what we live in, if you want to get technical about it, is a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, or democratically represented republic. But, you know, it's really all about trying to get the word Republican out there. That's why they don't even like to say Democratic Party. 57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Sometimes, you know, by the way, our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson. Tom Hartman here with you. From Thomas Jefferson, I would rather be exposed to the inconveniences attending too much liberty than to those attending too small a degree of it. Yeah, it sounds like a, you know, good plan. It's definitely a good plan to me. Definitely. Sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes you don't know what you do know. And sometimes, you know, actually, who was it? Don Rumsfeld said, it's the unknown unknowns that will get you. So, you know, sometimes you know, and sometimes you don't even know what you don't know. And sometimes, of course, everything you know is
wrong. You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. And think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, by the way, sponsored by TheLiberalStore.com with the and at all things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Check out the liberal teddy bear there at TheLiberalStore.com. Peter Navarro is with us. His website, PeterNavarro.com. Peter, N-A-V-A-R-R-O.com. He's the author of The Coming China Wars, Where They'll Be Fought and How They'll Be Won. You know, Peter, welcome first of all to the program.
Hey, Tom, and congratulations. I opened up my L.A. Times this morning, and there you were in all your glory.
Oh, geez.
Nice piece there.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thank you. I don't think most Americans think of China in terms of anything other than cheap stuff they can buy at Walmart. You know, it's tragic, frankly, how few Americans realize how bad things like human rights are in China. But the idea that we may ultimately be at war with China, or even in some low level, we might even currently be at war with China, is something that I think is completely off the radar screen for most Americans. Tell us about this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Tom. And I think the part of the problem is that our politicians and our pundits are totally preoccupied in looking straight ahead at Iraq. And meanwhile, on our flanks, since about the year 2000, China has been waging what I regard to be an undeclared economic war against us. And here's the deal. I mean, people think that, well, all these cheap products we get from China, it's simply because China's got a lot of cheap labor, and that's how they win the game. But the fact of the matter is, Tom, I've looked at basically the drivers of Chinese competitiveness, and there's five big unfair trading practices that are killing the manufacturing base of America, taking jobs from Americans and depressing our wages. Export subsidies, huge export subsidies they run that are violations of the World Trade Organization. Currency undervaluation, I think people might be attuned to that. China grossly undervalues their currency, which allows them to sell their exports cheap. Piracy and counterfeiting, rampant. Now, a lot of people here, again, there's misconceptions here, Tom. People think it's just Hollywood DVDs or Louis Vuitton purses. In fact, it's A to Z in terms of what they do. You got autos, auto parts, batteries, condoms, all the way to toilets, elevators, and Zippo lighters. If we're making it here in America, Tom, they're faking it. And you know what? That gives the Chinese manufacturers an edge, a cost advantage. They don't have to pay R&D. They don't have to pay marketing.
Yeah, well, this gets back to the technology transfers. I mean, which is massive. So many companies are moving their manufacturing over to China, and the Chinese companies are going, this is cool. We'll figure out how this works, and we'll just do it ourselves.
Well, one of the nasty things that's happening right now politically, Tom, is that as more and more corporations offshore from America to China, there's less and less political will to fight the unfair trade practices.
Right.
I mean, five years ago, it was labor and business standing, albeit uneasily, together, railing against unfair Chinese trading practices. Now, the AFL-CIO, I mean, I was in D.C. a couple of weeks ago testifying in a hearing. The AFL-CIO is the only one left standing on that. Meanwhile, the National Association of Manufacturers is becoming more and more split in terms of their China policy.
Yeah. Now, you said that there were 5 points, and you'd gotten through four when I interrupted you about technology transfers. What was the fifth?
Well, yeah, you got export subsidies, currency undervaluation, piracy and counterfeiting. Two more include the lax environmental health and safety standards in China. Now, China is the most dangerous place to work in the world. China is the most polluted country in the world. Anybody who's been to Beijing or Shanghai or Guangzhou realizes that the pollution there is absolutely horrific. Again, that provides real cost advantages. If you don't have to pay for pollution control technologies, if you can just dump toxic chemicals into the river instead of
it's called internalizing profits and externalizing costs.
Exactly.
And
we pay. I mean, look, it's, and what's going on here? It's kind of like the frog in the water that's coming to a slow boil. I mean, basically, what China's doing now, they're using these unfair trading practices to export to the U.S., kill our job base. Meanwhile, they recycle their surplus greenbacks back into the U.S., and what do? They buy our bonds, which means they're financing our budget deficits. The Treasury Department and the Bush administration like that because they don't have to worry about dealing with fiscal responsibility, so they keep their mouths shut.
But now the Chinese have so much of our debt that they've got us by the, you know, whatever.
Exactly.
Fill in your metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. And basically, it's a three-stage process. We're only in the first stage of losing our political independence. I mean, first of all, yes, they're our de facto central banker now, Tom, but they just announced a couple of weeks ago that they're going to put $200 billion now, their foreign currency reserves, in the stock markets around the world. Most of it's going into the U.S. And the third stage is going to be...
Which means they're buying up our company, our domestic companies.
Yeah, they'll start buying our companies.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean? That means that the rate of technology transfer accelerates. It means that decisions as to whether or not to offshore or outsource
It means that the profits don't stay in America. The profits go to China. It means that decisions are being made that may affect the national interests in Beijing rather than in Manhattan or Washington, D.C. or Detroit. Let me take it a step farther here. We're talking with Peter Navarro. PeterNavarro.com, his new book, China Wars, where they will be fought and how they will be won. Peter, for 200 years in the United States, I mean, literally from 1787 when the first official tariff laws were passed, right up until Reagan began deconstructing them, and I mean, we still have tariffs, but Reagan really began the process, and then Bush Sr., and then Bill Clinton, really took the thing apart with the NAFTA and WTO and all this. We had a policy where we said, if it costs, a dollar's worth of labor to make a pair of shoes in the United States, and you want to make that pair of shoes somewhere else, let's say in China, where it's 10 cents worth of labor, that's fine. We can't stop you. It's a free world, or it's a free country. But when you import them, when they hit our border, we're going to hit you with a 90-cent tax to reflect the difference in the cost of that labor. So you have your choice. You can make them here for a buck, or you can make them there for 10 cents plus 90-cent tax, which costs a buck, too. And most people said, most manufacturers for 200 years said, we'll keep making shoes in the United States, and televisions, and computers, and cars, and steel, and, on the list goes, right? We don't, clothing, I mean, whatever. And when we got into this so-called corporate free trade thing where we did away with all these tariffs, now, I mean, if General Motors wants to import a car into China, they have to pay a 20% import duty. But if a Chinese company wants to export a car into the United States, it's only a 2% import duty.
Right.
Why don't we go back to using tariffs And in fact, even expand them perhaps beyond just protecting labor, but also say, oh, and by the way, if you're gaining an advantage over American companies because you're putting massive amounts of mercury into the air in your manufacturing process, because I live in Portland, Oregon, where we actually, 25% of all the mercury that comes out of our rain that's polluting our rivers is coming from China.
Absolutely. And I've got a whole chapter in the book about
right.
that.
Right. Why don't we just go back to using, we only have a minute left here, Peter. Why don't we just go back to using tariffs?
Well, look, the way we need to protect ourselves is not against cheap labor per se. We can beat cheap labor with our technology. What we can't beat, Tom, is when they cheat. We can't beat export subsidies. We can't beat currency manipulation. We can't beat a workplace environment which is basically slave labor and indentured servitude and no health and safety protections. That's where you come in and you put in tariffs, which are, you know, protectionism has become a four-letter word. There's sometimes when you legitimately need to protect your country.
I am proud to say I am a protectionist, Peter. Well, you know, I'll put it right out there. It worked for 200 years in this country. It built the greatest industrial powerhouse in the history of the world. And in the last 26 years, these economic conservatives, they call themselves, have dismantled it. And not only are they destroying the American middle class, but they're stripping apart the ability of this country to defend itself.
Well, my rule is protectionism and tariffs are perfectly appropriate when you protect yourself against unfair trading practices. Congress needs to act. The president needs to act. We've got Treasury Secretary who's Neville Chamberlain rather.
Yeah. Amen. Amen. Issue. We're out of time. Peter Navarro. PeterNavarro.com is the website, the book, The Coming China Wars. Peter, thanks a lot.
You take care.
You too. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, 21 minutes past the hour. David Sirota with us. DavidSirota.com is website. Hey, David, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you back on the program here. You're right up at the top of Sirota blog, your website, DavidSirota.com. The strong majority of America supports cutting off funding for Iraq escalation. How do you see this thing playing out?
Well, I'm disturbed that the debate is all about non-binding resolutions, and I know that the rationale is that, you know, the Senate has to get 60 votes for something to pass. But my problem with that is, if you're only debating a non-binding resolution that doesn't do anything anyway, why not be with the majority of the public, as the CNN poll shows today, 60% of the public wants Congress to cut off funding for Bush's escalation. So why is the debate in Congress over non-binding resolutions? And so the way I see it playing out is I think ultimately this pressure, the Congress can't sustain this kind of public pressure without actually doing something. And I think that what actually happens, I mean, that's anybody's guess.
Yeah, well, the argument is that, you know, by doing a non-binding resolution, you're getting the discussion out there, you're getting the debate started, and that as a consequence of that, that initial process, then you can go to something more draconian or more serious.
Well, and I guess I see that strategy at this exact moment, meaning, okay, we've had that debate over the non-binding resolution. You know, we have 54 senators on record, or 56, saying they basically want the non-binding resolution. So let's stop with that at this point, and let's start talking about actually doing something, which I know at least Jack Murtha is poised to do, but I haven't seen much in the Senate. And what's really unclear is whether doing something real will become an official position of the Democratic Party or not. That's the key question, because Democrats control Congress.
Yeah. So what's your sense of this, David? I mean, you're in many ways kind of a political insider. I realize you're kind of on the outside now in the Midwest, but you know the corridors of power in Washington, D.C. What's your sense of how it's going to shake out?
Well, my take is that Murtha has a proposal to essentially not allow troops who are not up to a certain training standard, American troops.
Yeah, which you would think is absolutely impossible to oppose, and yet they're savaging him for this.
Right, I know, and it's unbelievable. And I guess I think that that's the strategy that's ultimately going to win the day. That it's so impossible to oppose. It's so rational. I mean, who is going to stand up on the floor of the Senate or the House and say we need to send troops who aren't properly trained into battle in Iraq? I mean, I think if the Republicans really go down that route, they are really trying to help seal a permanent Democratic majority.
But they're doing what they always do, and they're doing what they often do, and that is reinventing it as a completely different issue. I mean, they're arguing that Murtha's proposal is not that it somehow is failing to support the troops, or it's not, you know, it's you're in favor of defeat, or they're coming out with all these phrases and jargon that is just obscuring the issue. And frankly, I'm not seeing the media do a decent job at all of representing what Murtha is proposing.
Yeah, I would agree with that, although the saving grace in all this is that I think that the Republicans have so overplayed their hand. They're still living with sort of Vietnam-era epithets of, you know, you're weak on defense, you hate the troops. And I just think that the public has matured past that. The public can see through this. I mean, if we have a CNN poll today that shows that 60% of Americans want Congress to cut off funding for the escalation, the public is way, way ahead of Washington and the media on this. Yeah. They get what's going on.
Yeah, as is so often the case. We just have a minute left, David. In your mind, the top issues of the day?
The top issues of the day, I think, are going to be obviously Iraq. I think that trade policy is going to explode in the new Congress. You've got Bush asking for further authority to push more and more of these corporate-written free trade deals that have sold out the middle class. And I think that ultimately is going to – we're going to really see whether the Democrats are serious about representing the majority that they won or whether they're not. And my hope is that they are serious, but it remains to be seen.
Yeah, my hope is that we can get enough people, you know, enough of we the people, enough people at the base active and out there and speaking out and, you know, to grab Congress by the lapels and say, no, you will represent us.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let me make a quick plug. The sure. Progressive States Network, www.progressivestates.org, we are running a 50-state campaign against the Iraq war, asking state legislators to sponsor resolutions demanding Congress act on this. It's 25 states have already introduced it, and I hope listeners will go to our website. There's a tool there. You can connect with your legislators and demand that they take action.
With your state legislators?
With your state legislators.
Have any states passed this?
Well, the Iowa Senate just passed it last week. The California Senate passed it. Vermont's Senate and House passed it. It's coming up for a vote here in Montana in the coming weeks.
But
so
none of them have made it through a governor's signature and
not yet. No, not yet. But I have every hope and expectation that these bills are going to continue moving as the Congress continues to do nothing.
Yeah, I believe you're right. And this, just like every other significant change in America, is going to be driven from the bottom up, and that's the best thing. David Sirota, davidsirota.com, progressivestates.org, you said?
That's right.
Yeah, great. David, thanks so much.
Thanks,
for being
Tom.
Good talking with you, as always. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change in America. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us. Boy, this is grim news. Just a kind of a heads up what's going on in Iraq. A Sunni woman announced on Al Jazeera on Monday. Remember Sunni Shia, right? A Sunni, the minority in Iraq, the old, you know, the the old Saddam, Saddam was a Sunni, the Saudis are Sunni. Okay, so anyhow, a Sunni woman announced on Al Jazeera to the Arab world, basically, that she had been kidnapped and raped by three officers of the Iraqi National Police. Now, this is a police force that answers to Prime Minister Maliki, a Shiite. And so he immediately came out, and this was last Monday, he immediately came out and said, we're going to investigate this. Now, Slate.com is reporting, he has now come out and publicly condemned this woman, said that she's a criminal, made her name public, thus, you know, I mean, this a society where women don't have a whole lot of rights and protections to begin with, although actually in Iraq and under Saddam, women had more rights and privileges than in most of the Middle Eastern countries, and announced that the three officers who she identified as having raped her will be honored. And so the Sunni-Shia tensions are, how do you say it, dramatically increasing. This is, if you don't think we're in the middle of a civil war, let me tell you, this is such a mess. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, yeah. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I agree 100% with your last guest, David Sirota, that these non-binding resolutions on the war in Iraq and its escalation are not good enough. And meanwhile, the democratically controlled Congress seems poised to give Bush all the funds in full that he has asked for in order to continue his unjustified war in Iraq.
Yeah, it's almost like they're still listening to Bob Shrum. You know, they're still listening to the advisors who lost a whole series of elections.
Exactly.
Not to pick on Bob specifically. I'm sure he's a very decent guy. But it's just there's been so much timidity in the Democratic Party over the last 15 years or so.
Exactly, and but it's interesting you mentioned Bob Shrum. He was involved in the campaigns of both Al Gore and John Kerry, and he advised John Kerry not to fight back with respect to the Swift Bug veteran aides. He's one of the people who advised that. But I personally think what needs to be done with respect to the Iraq war is that I think Congress, especially now the Democrats control it, what they need to do is they need to hold back at least some portion of the new money that Bush has requested for the war in Iraq, especially that portion of the money that does not go to funding our troops, but instead goes to other purposes, such as into the pockets of those defense contractors, such as Halliburton and other defense contractors, for that matter. And then Senator Obama has some interesting legislation that has been introduced but not yet voted on. This is the thing that kills me, too. There's interesting legislation, like Senator Obama has something called the Iraq War De-escalation Act of 2007 that would both place a cap on the number of troops Bush can send to Iraq, and it would also require the removal of all combat troops in the war zone in Iraq by March 31st of 2008, little over a year from
now. And this is something that Harry Reid should be moving to the front of the line.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you had...
Problem is, though, that it will not make it past a filibuster. I mean, if you can't get a non-binding resolution passed, you're not going to get that passed. And that's it.
Well,
but nonetheless, it still should be out there.
That as well. You know, I have thoughts on that as well. I mean, I don't know why Harry Reid isn't being more of a leader and isn't going to Republicans.
Because he's not hearing from enough of us, Jerry. I mean, that's the bottom line, is that these guys, we don't elect leaders in this country. And this is the thing. And Jerry, thank you very much for the call. This is the thing we all have to get. And so many people, I think, don't get is we don't elect leaders. We elect representatives. Their job is to represent us. And if we're not doing our job in a constitutionally limited democratic republic, if we're not doing our job, a representative democratic republic, of telling our representatives how we want them to represent us, then, you know, we shouldn't be complaining when they don't. So it's not enough just to say, it's terrible. You know, call Harry Reid's office, call Congress, let them know what you think. Give them a calling is actually the most effective way. Those people who are committee chair people and those and the leader, like, you know, leaders like Harry Reid, anybody can call them. And if you have a senator, obviously we all have two senators, except people in Washington, D.C., call your senators I mean, this seems to be where the bottleneck is happening, is in the Senate. Although I'd say call your member of the House of Representatives as well and tell that person, hey, you know, enough already. It's time for peace. Peace is actually a powerful and positive force. I want to do a show just on peace here in the next couple of days, you know, like Jack Kennedy's take on peace. But anyhow, Nathan in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Nathan, welcome.
Hi.
My old stomping grounds. I grew up in Michigan. Our oldest daughter was born in Detroit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, great to hear from you.
Well, I wasn't born in Detroit, but I spent a good chunk of my life here.
Yeah.
And this is about public education. I don't know if you heard about it. The Detroit teachers started this school year with an illegal strike. It's illegal in Michigan for teachers to go on strike, unfortunately. Right. And first of all, you know, my doctor, and when I saw him this week, had something to say about No Child Left Behind. What he says to me is, I'm really worried that the next thing they're going to pass No Patient Left Behind that I'll be stuck with.
They may well. I mean, you know, and when you get it, what you have to get, I get it that you get it, Nathan, but what all our listeners have to get as well, and thank you for calling and making that point, is that the No Child Left Behind program, just like Medicare Part D, these were poison pills. These were designed to destroy what they were being marketed as helping. It's, you know, quite straightforward. No Child Left Behind was designed to destroy public education, and it is. And just like the Medicare Part D was designed to destroy Medicare by bankrupting it, and it is causing major problems for the funding of bankruptcy. For the funding of Medicare. Kathy in Long Branch, New Jersey. Hey, Kathy.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
Okay, we have meetings with our congressman here in Long Branch, and at one of our recent meetings, we had just won the election, and he's concerned that if we don't stop funding this war, that they'll lose their jobs in a couple of years.
That's great. Who's
your
congressman?
He won't, because he gets reelected by 67% of the vote down here. You know, it's Frank Malone.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But in any event, he said he doesn't have a whole lot of confidence in Harry Reid to stop the funding for some reason, but he has a lot of confidence in Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
She's very adamant against this war, and she's been from day one.
Yep.
So I just wanted to put that out there, that there's some people that are really fighting for us, and
yep.
Nancy and Frank are two of them. And
I agree.
We have Jersey as the best good people, I think.
You do. You do. You absolutely do, Kathy.
It's such a crazy connection I have when I talk to you, because it sounds so far away, and I'm on a landline phone and stuff, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's sometimes electronics are a little odd. But thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. Jack in Oceanside, California. Thanks for listening on WWRL there. Jack in Oceanside, California. Hey, Jack.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the nuclear option. The Republicans were very successful at just threatening it. It seems to me that the Democrats, in order to get anything accomplished in the Senate,
you're right,
are going to have to change the rules to be able to stop a filibuster with a simple majority.
That's right.
Why haven't they talked about it?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because the Bush administration right now in the back rooms, and this was reported, it is a small piece. I think I saw it in the Wall Street Journal yesterday. It might have been the New York Times. About how inside the Bush administration they're having these kind of backslapping conversations about, well, we got another 2 years, and odds are we'll get another Supreme Court justice. And the Republicans, even though they're the minority in the Senate, they know that they control enough votes to be able to screw things up for the Democrats. And my guess is that they're going to, actually you could play the logic out on this. You could argue either side of that with this. But,
well, you know, I know that the argument against it was, well, what's going to happen if the other side gets control of this tool and we lose power? But here's something that you're probably aware of. In 2008, there's going to be 21 Republican senators coming up for re-election and only 12 Democratic senators.
Yeah, I know.
So
yeah.
The odds are we're going to be gaining seats in the Senate in 2008.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons that you're hearing a lot of Republicans start talking. You know, like one of my senators, Gordon Smith from Oregon, all of a sudden he's starting to talk like a Democrat. You know, it's like, hey, wait a minute, what happened? I thought that you were a right-wing crank.
But Tom, isn't it becoming apparent, Tom, that the only way we're actually going to be able to reverse what Bush has done is for the Democrats to have control of the House, Senate, and the presidency?
Probably, ultimately, Jack, it is, yeah. Although a lot can be done by the legislature. Thanks for the call, Jack. Mariana, never underestimate the activated populace. Mariana, we just have a few seconds, half a minute here before I have to take a quick break. Is it a quick one?
All right. Well, I was going to comment on the right of citizens to, or human beings, to an education and to health care. And
mm-hmm.
I just think
so you agree with me?
I agree with you totally. I think that it's in the Constitution, not only because the first paragraph states a lot of the aims of the Constitution, and I don't think many people in government have been working toward that.
But right.
Not only that, if we all are considered equal and we have certain basic human and civil rights, then I think, health care and food
healthcare
and water.
Yeah, there should be among them.
Them.
Yeah, Marianne, very eloquently said. Although the we're all created equal part is out of the Declaration of Independence, and it's created not equal, not equal, but anyway, 45 minutes past it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes before the hour, this from the wire services, as they say in the real news business. In perhaps the most troubling sign yet for his presidency, a poll released today shows that a majority of Americans wish that George W. Bush was a fictitious character rather than a real person. Mr. Bush's popularity has taken some serious hits in recent months, but the new survey marks the first time that over 50% of respondents indicated that they wished the president was a figment of their imagination. When asked the question, if you could choose whether George W. Bush was a real person or a fictitious character, 51% said fictitious character, while only 42% said real person, with the remaining 7% responding, George W. Bush is a fictitious character. Even more troubling for the president is the survey's conclusion that in theoretical matchups with other fictitious characters, Mr. Bush would be trounced. According to the poll, which has a margin of error of 5 percentage points, if an election were held today between Mr. Bush and the superhero Aquaman, Mr. Bush would lose to Aquaman by a margin of 2-1. And Mr. Bush would suffer a similar fate in hypothetical face-offs with other such fictitious characters as the Little Mermaid, the Easter Bunny, and SpongeBob SquarePants. At the White House, spokesman Tony Snow said the poll results were, in their own way, good news for the president. He said the American people want the president to be fictitious. Well, his reasons for invading Iraq were fictitious, so he's really meeting them halfway. No, it's not really from the Warriors. Sorry. It's with thanks to Andy Borowitz from BorowitzReport.com. A little tongue-in-cheek news. Let's get some real news. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., TalkRadioNews.com on the line. Hey, Victoria, you're not fictitious.
No, I'm for real, but I found myself thinking, you know, if he's fictitious and you put him in J.K. Rowling's seventh Harry Potter book, who knows what could happen to him, because everybody seems to be killed off in that book, and it's a scary thing. There's so much magic going on.
Well, it's interesting how many movies there seems to be a small subtext, you know, like V for Vendetta. There was kind of I don't know if you saw it, there was this subtext of what's going on with the Bush administration right now. The new movie Pan's Labyrinth, I thought was just one of the most brilliant movies I've ever seen. You know, it's about the rise of fascism in Spain, but it just, I kept thinking about, you know, what's going on in America right now as I was watching that movie. They're increasingly, I think maybe it's just that we're all sensitized to it, but just
I think it's very healthy when the arts start to reflect what's happening.
Yeah, well, it certainly happened during the Vietnam War. I mean, you know, you could say that Tommy and what was his brother's name, Smothers, you know, the Smothers brothers, helped you know bring down Nixon or bring down LBJ for that matter. I mean, LBJ was told by his own party, "Sorry, Charlie, you're not going to run again," and and the old Smothers Brothers show. But anyhow, that what's happening in Washington, D.C. these days?
Well, a couple of things really going on. One is that the jury in the Scooter Libby trial has retired to deliberate. We don't know which way they're going to jump. We don't know whether they took a quick poll and decided, oh, we all agree, oh, well, we better deliberate for 2 or 3 hours so it doesn't look too obvious. Well, I mean, we don't know what they're going to do in this case. This is the trial of Scooter Libby as to whether he committed perjury and attempted to obstruct justice in the outing of Valerie Plame as a CIA agent.
Right.
Both sides put on a fairly workmanlike case. Scooter Libby didn't testify, and we didn't hear all about the conspiracy to protect Karl Rove, which we were promised we would hear about.
Now, Victoria, with regard to that, this list from the news, this is the New York Daily News from James Gordon Meek, their Washington bureau. He just did this great little summary. These are the people who leaked the name of the covert CIA agent that we now know leaked the name.
Right.
Vice President Cheney, Karl Rove, Richard Armitage, Ari Fleischer, Dan Bartlett, Robert Grenier, Bill Harlow, Kathy Martin, Mark Grossman, and Craig Schmall. And these are all members of the Bush administration. Why have none of these people been prosecuted for this?
Because in order to prosecute for this particular crime, you have to knowingly do it. And you have to know that the person is covert, and there has to be some kind of intent behind it. And it seems that the prosecutor didn't think that he had enough on them. I mean, this is a guy who's going after somebody for perjury. I firmly believe that this prosecutor, if he thought he could get any of them, would get them.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting.
The other big story, of course, is Tony Blair's announcement. He's Prime Minister of Great Britain. That he's withdrawing a whole slew of troops from Iraq, and Vice President Cheney putting a happy face on this, saying that this is a good sign. This, to a great extent, is about Tony Blair's legacy, what little legacy he's possibly going to have, and about him trying to protect himself. But it doesn't look good for the Bush administration, even though there is a definite slant on the part of the Bush administration to say that it does.
Do you think it's possible that Blair is pulling these troops out now? Well, actually, there's a couple of possibilities. One, he's doing it in response to domestic pressure inside the UK. Two, he's doing it because he actually thinks that, you know, there's things are quieting down in that area and he can pull them down. Or three, because he's concerned that Bush is going to start a war with Iran, which is Shia, and his troops, the UK troops, are all in the Shia south. And if we start a war with Iran, all hell is going to break loose with the Shia, and Blair doesn't want his people in the line of fire.
I think one and two are true, and I think three is a distinct possibility.
Interesting. Interesting. So do you think that there are going to be more revelations coming out of the Blair cabinet and out of the Blair administration about the Downing Street minutes and memos around Iraq? Do you expect things coming down around Iran? Are you hearing that kind of buzz?
No, I'm not hearing anything more coming out, really. I mean, we had the Downing Street memo. I haven't heard anything about Iran. I'm sure if there is anything, it will be leaked. There are enough people in that cabinet, or at least connected to that cabinet, who are unhappy that anything that is there will leak. People around Blair are mostly concerned about protecting themselves in the wake of this honors for cash scandal.
Oh, yeah, that's right, which America has totally lost track of, but it's still a big deal in the UK.
Huge deal.
Yeah. Okay, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thanks very much.
Always great to check in with you. Coming up tomorrow, by the way, we're going to have a great show, the top news of the day. Plus, hang on, as conservative Christopher J. Kicka and I take opposite sides on the question about hate crime legislation. Does it go too far? Lawrence O'Donnell will be here on the issues of the day, that and your calls, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.